Good afternoon, please be seated.
Ms. Dustin, Mr. Sweeten, welcome. This is the northern panel, which we like to call the Nevada panel, and we've tried to make it easy on our attorneys from Clark County, defense attorneys, prosecutors, by being down here for cases where we do the overflow of Clark County from the southern panel, plus we do Washoe and the rurals. So we're glad to be here, and we're glad that when we finish, you just need to go back up downstairs or upstairs or wherever you go, and you don't have to worry about driving to Reno with ice and snow and stuff up there. This is case number, and just to say that we'll listen to this on the audio, and she'll participate in this disposition. This is case number 52807, George versus State. Ms. Dustin for the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honors. I've reserved 3 minutes on this particular matter. Again, for the record, Cynthia Dustin for the appellant, Donald George. Your Honors, in 1984 is when this case started, and that's when Brandy George made an allegation that her then-acting father, Donald George, sexually assaulted her. This disclosure was made at a school, and the police were called to come out. Ms. George was then transported to UMC, where a sexual assault evaluation and examination was done by a Dr. Karsh. There was a nurse present as well. As normally done in sexual assault examinations, Brandy was asked varying questions regarding what had happened to her. Dr. Karsh made notes that Brandy discussed that she had only been penile vaginal insertion. She had also been inserted in her vagina by a douche tip. She denied any allegation of any oral contact in the fact that she had not had to place her mouth on Donald George's penis, nor had Donald George placed his mouth on her vagina area. She had previously said during some of her interviews that the last contact that she had had was that day earlier at 12:05 a.m. Now, she was seen in UMC shortly, probably after 2 p.m. in the afternoon, and she said that at 12:05 in the morning, when she was last sexually assaulted, that it was very violent, and she was sexually assaulted until she bled from her vagina.
How old was she at that time?
At that time, she was approximately 11 years old. Okay. She may have been 10 going on 11. She was a little unclear as to exactly when, but we believe it's when she was 11 years old. Okay. Now, Dr. Karsh examined her at that particular time, and he made findings that there was no trauma evident at all to support her allegations that she had been brutally raped just hours before. He noted also during the trial that had this happened, he would have still seen signs of trauma evident even hours later. Now, what he did note was that there was no hymen present in Brandy at the time that he evaluated her and examined her, and that he did note that it appeared that her vaginal cavity was looser than what he would normally expect on a 10 or an 11-year-old child. He noted that the absence of her hymen could have been due to the fact that she could have engaged in not only sexual conduct, but self-stimulation, and he was not going to opine any further as to that, but he did note that the hymen was completely absent. Now, he also noted that Brandy's demeanor was very unusual because she was very calm, and he actually made notes of that and said that that was unusual because a lot of times the victims were upset, traumatized, crying. They were not just completely calm. Now, Brandy then spoke later to Detective Larson, and this is the same day. She gave a voluntary statement to Detective Larson, again, detailing what had happened to her. She limited her descriptions to only, again, penile-vaginal contact and the douche tip being inserted, again, no oral contact at all, and that there was some denotation about whether there was touching of the hands to the vagina. Detective Larson noted that there was nothing else, and he did go through her and ask her repetitively, is there anything else that happened that you need to talk to me about? What also came forward during the time that Detective Larson was talking to her was that she had been engaged in repetitive sexual intercourse with Adam George, who was Donald George's older son that was living in the house at the same time. She also talked about that there was also sexual misconduct with Viola George and that she had to watch Donald George have sex with Viola. However, that was not charged in the information that Mr. George went to trial on. Now, the case ended up going to trial in 1985, January 1985, and Mr. George was convicted. And Justice Gibbons, you did sit on the panel that penned the opinion that reversed his convictions, noting that there was no transcript ever prepared. All the exhibits had been destroyed, and you remanded it back to district court for a whole new trial. Now, we got to trial in 2008 before Judge Lohr. Prior to hitting trial, there was a motion that the defense brought to dismiss the entire case because the record was completely gone. We had no transcripts anymore, and we had none of the exhibits that were previously admitted at trial. What's relevant here is the sexual assault kit that was collected from Brandy on her sexual assault examination. Now, we did have the report that noted that Brandy's findings when they did do the testing on her showed that there was no seminal fluid. Dr. Karsh noted that he saw no spermatozoa present underneath the light and that there was no acid phosphatase present either. We had that report. Judge Lohr, even though the state had not responded to that particular motion, Judge Lohr denied the motion to dismiss, saying that we could stipulate to the fact that the report existed and the fact that there was no evidence, no physical evidence linking that Donald George had done anything to Brandy like she had claimed, because she had said at 12:05 when she was last sexually assaulted that no condom was used and Donald George ejaculated into her. So Judge Lohr said the report was the report and it would stand on there, and forced a stipulation that we would agree to the admission of the report.
Is it forced a stipulation?
Well, Your Honor, I'm going to be honest and say that I was opposed to it. That's why I had filed the motion to dismiss, and I was basically told, you're going to need to stipulate into it. We weren't really given any other option. The report, the sexual assault kit was gone. We were unable to test it. We claimed that there was issues, and how this becomes relevant is what happens later on in the case. Now, the case came back in 2006. 2008, we got to jury trial, and this is July 2008 that we were initially finally set to go announcing ready to jury trial. Shortly thereafter, the state brought a motion saying that they had new evidence that had never been disclosed before, dating back to 24 to 25 years ago, that Donald George had molested another child in his home, and that is Felicia McLando. The initial motion that the state brought was that they didn't have a name, but they had heard that there were some other incidents and other actions that had been coming forward. Judge Lohr basically denied that motion and said, if you have somebody that saw Donald George having sexual relations with Brandy, you can bring them, but otherwise, no. The state then discovered that they had a name for somebody and filed a motion to bring that exact person, Felicia Milando, to trial. This pushed off our trial because we'd already announced ready, and Judge Lohr agreed that we should have a little bit of time. So in August of 2008, we had a Petricioli hearing for Felicia Milando, where she came and testified as to her recollections of what had happened between Donald George and herself. Judge Lohr, while finding that it was clear and convincing as to her dissertation, basically said that she was withholding her verdict until jury trial, and she wanted to hear Brandy George's testimony. During jury trial, Brandy George now began advancing theories that had never been present. From 1984, all of her statements, it had never existed, and now she was claiming that the defendant had told her to urinate on him, that there was oral contact, that she was forced to masturbate Donald George, that she was supposed to perform fellatio on him, and that he performed cunnilingus on her, that he touched her breast, that he inserted his fingers into her vagina. This was never discussed at any time in 1984. This is why it made it critical that at this point the transcripts were lost and we were unable to challenge what her previous testimony was. We were stuck with a preliminary hearing transcript to which Brandy, when she was cross-examined with it, was merely claiming that she wasn't asked the right questions. She was also confronted with her statements to Detective Larson. Again, she said she wasn't asked the right statements. She couldn't understand, even though some of the questions were exactly what happened to you, what did he do to you, did anything else happen? So, needless to say, Judge Lohr, after Brandy George, in the middle of Brandy George's cross-examination by the defense, then made a ruling that the defense had opened the door to allowing the bad act evidence to come in underneath the state's theory of a complete story doctrine. Judge Lohr claimed that this is because I myself, as the trial attorney, had inquired of Brandy George of whether she knew of anybody else in the house being sexually assaulted. Now, the record, if you review the record, there was never any such question asked by the defense ever, and even the state has not been able to provide a cite to the record of anywhere in there that question was asked of Brandy George. So unfortunately, it was manifest error for Judge Lohr to make the ruling that she did because it was not supported by the record. While the state would claim that still the evidence could have come in underneath the motive exception, motive was not the reason why Judge Lohr said that this evidence could come in. What Judge Lohr said was the evidence was coming in because of the question and because it would invoke the complete story doctrine, which was an error. Harmless error is acceptable for omitting these bad acts, but here what the jury heard was there was some conflicting testimony regarding Brandy George. They had heard that there was no trauma, that they had heard that her stories to Detective Larson differed over a 25-year period. There was nothing else to support what her accusations were aside from her allegations. There was no physical evidence to back this up because her hymen being missing, she admitted to having repetitive sexual intercourse with Adam. So therefore, allowing the jury to hear that Donald George had had sexual relations with another female in a substantial manner as to what happened to Brandy George became error. It did impugn upon his trial rights and had a substantial influence on the jury in that the state now has been able to say, this is what he does. I know the state will have a variety of positions on this. However, I think even the case law supports that we didn't quite hit it to allow underneath the theory that Judge Lohr did, and so it was error to admit it. There was extra issues regarding the testimony of Dr. Karsh coming in, and while I would agree that Dr. Karsh is a medical doctor and he did do a 3-month gynecology rotation back when he was in training, he is not a gynecology juvenile expert, and instead he was presented as such. If he had just stayed with the fact that he had examined Brandy, related his findings, there really would have been no issue. But as I objected to the court, I said, Dr. Karsh, while he presents a wonderful resume, he's great at giving information about cardiac distress and toxicology regarding drugs, but not as to female, let alone juvenile female gynecology. So it was error to allow him to come in on that. NRS 50.275 notes that you are allowed to provide an expert to help the jury with discerning evidence, but that expert really needs to be in the field that they're testifying to and not into some oblique field. And I think,
but if he's an MD, isn't that all it's sufficient to give medical opinions? And then you can certainly cross-examine him on the amount of experience he has.
Of course, Your Honor. However, the dilemma that ends up being is when you have somebody that's going into and opining beyond, I examined this young lady, this is what I saw that was unusual in her demeanor because I had done other SANE exams, when he's opining as to how things happen within the female vagina of a juvenile, he doesn't quite have the level of expertise that a gynecologist would. That's why we have, unfortunately, fields of specialization such as that. Lastly, Your Honors, I did argue that there was insufficient evidence, as I've argued that there was conflicting evidence throughout this case as to Brandy George's testimony and the evidence that was presented, and that all of these errors were cumulative in nature to deprive Donald George of a fair trial. Lastly, the lewdness charges that were alleged in counts 7, 8, and 9 did merge in with the sexual assault that was alleged, as if there was no specific and unique distinct evidence offered of Donald George doing a separate touching of the vagina area with his hands or fingers. Lastly, that the current sentence that he was imposed was greater than his previous sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nissen. Sweeten, on behalf of the State of Nevada, Clark County District Attorney Deputy.
May it please the Court, Chief Sweeten, for the respondent. I'd first like to reference what's noted as issue number 7 in the appellant's brief, and that's the sentence exceeds the prior sentence given. And I would note that upon a review of the record, it would appear that the intent of the judge was to sentence the defendant to the same sentence he had been sentenced to before. I think that it was this sort of comes into a mistake of fact sort of analysis, and the state is not going to oppose the defendant being resentenced to the sentence that he was sentenced to before. I would also note in regards to issue number six, and that's the issue dealing with the redundancy issue of between the lewdness and the sexual assault counts. I would note that this contention is directly refuted by the record, and I would reference to the appendix page 437, lines 14 through 17, where the victim specifically asked, in regards to the defendant placing his penis and finger in your vagina, did he do that less than five times or more than five times? The victim responded, way more than five times. The state would submit, or the respondent would submit, certainly this is at least six times when the defendant inserted both his penis and his finger inside of the victim's vagina. We have here three counts of sexual assault, penis and vagina, that the defense is contending, appellant is contending, is actually redundant with three counts of lewdness fondling the vagina with the hand. The state would submit that certainly three of those counts, as described by the victim, would satisfy the elements for penile penetration of the vagina. The remaining three, certainly the hand being placed on the vagina, is necessary to insert the finger in the vagina, and therefore the elements of a lewdness in regards to those other counts would also be met. Certainly the lewdness element of sexual gratification is certainly met by the evidence in this case. I'd like to go through issue by issue of the appellant's issues, if I might, starting with issue number one, and that deals with denying the motion to dismiss, the lower court denying the appellant's motion to dismiss, in which the defendant contended that there was a due process violation resulting from the destruction of essentially the sexual assault kit, and the loss of unduly prejudiced the defendant's case, and the evidence possessed an exculpatory value that was apparent before the evidence was destroyed. Now, it's clear that the burden of showing the materiality here is upon the defendant in this case, and the state submits that there was no prejudice here. The exculpatory results from the processing of this destroyed evidence was preserved in the report of Mr. Merkable, and that was essentially that there was no acid phosphatase, which essentially tells us that there was no semen that was found at that time. Now, the victim indicated that she was sexually assaulted many hours before on that very same day. As a result of that, the state would submit that this evidence is clearly exculpatory to the defense. Now, the defense contends that it was deprived of the retesting of the rape kit and thereby refute Mr. Berkeley's testimony in this case, but the state would submit that the testimony is clearly exculpatory. And under this particular scenario, you wouldn't want to retest the sexual assault case when the results that you got could not be any better for the defense, the state would submit. Mr. Berkeley did testify that they might not expect to find semen because of the delay between the time of the sexual assault and the exam, but clearly the exculpatory nature here, this is clearly exculpatory, not inculpatory in the least. The defendant contends that the court erred in denying the defendant's motion before the state responded. In this particular case, there was a motion that was filed. The defense counsel, the state contacted the defense counsel. The attorney who was assigned the case was on vacation. There was an agreement that they would be given time to respond. We went to court. The court ended up issuing its ruling. Now, there's nothing in the rules of the court or in statute that prevent the court, upon reviewing a motion such as this, making a determination without merit, to deny the motion. In this particular case, the court certainly recognized the exculpatory nature of that has been preserved from the sexual assault kit, and in so doing, basically indicated that evidence, that exculpatory evidence was available, and the state was forced to stipulate that evidence coming in despite the sexual assault kit not being available, and that's what was done in this case. Finally, in regards to the destruction of trial transcripts, the state would submit that the defense had full opportunity to review all of the statements that were given in the course of the case, all of the police reports that were given in the course of the case, to interview whatever witnesses that they wanted. The trial transcript did result in the conviction of the defendant. The state submits that there's no prejudice in regards to the destruction of that transcript. In regards to the second issue, and that's the presentation of the other bad act evidence, I'd like to kind of lay a framework in regards to this. Initially, the state obtained information from the review of the reports indicating the surrounding circumstances relating to the household in which the defendant and the victim resided. And in that regard, there was much evidence in regards to the sort of dictatorial nature of that household. There was therefore a motion brought initially, a motion in limine, to present the whole story or to present other bad acts relating to the general circumstances of the household. Now, that particular motion, the court ruled that the witnesses could testify to any sexual contact that they saw between the defendant and the victim, but was limiting it to that. Subsequent to that time, upon interviewing one of the witnesses, actually one of the witnesses on the defense's witness list, who was another child that was residing in the house, the state became aware that that child as well had been sexually assaulted by the defendant. As a result of that, another motion was brought to admit other bad acts. And that motion was ultimately heard by the court, and a Petrocelli hearing was granted in regards to two of the victims in that case. Now, Tinch lays out the prerequisites in regards to other bad acts, the incidents relevant, proven by clear and convincing evidence, probative value substantially outweighs the danger of unfair prejudice. And in this case, the state, the court clearly, at the time of the Petrocelli hearing, recognized that the evidence was clear and convincing in regards to the acts. Now, after listening to the testimony of Brandy as the trial began, the court ultimately allowed evidence of another child victim in the house, a female victim, Felicia, as well as testimony of the victim's brother in this case, Adam, who the victim was caused at the defendant's direction to perform sexual acts with. Now, the state would submit that the court reasoned, as is clear from the record, and the holding of a Petrocelli hearing, that these are other bad acts meeting the requisites of the Tinch decision. Going forward, she recognized that in this particular case, there was a clear motive reason for admitting this evidence. And that's clear the state would submit in this particular case because the defendant in this case basically had the victims in his household. He had a dictatorial relationship with them. He essentially groomed these children to commit sexual acts and committed those sexual acts on the children. This was his clear motive from the evidence surrounding this. And I'd note the Ledbetter case, this is might even a more appropriate case than the Ledbetter case in regards to the motive exception, because in the Ledbetter case we had children who were in different states over an extended period of time, and in this particular case certainly the children were in the same household over, and things happened about the same periods of time over this period of time. The common scheme and plan exception is very appropriate in this case because that's what this was. This was an overreaching plan that the defendant had to groom these children and sexually offend on them. Ledbetter made reference also to the common scheme and plan and made reference in that particular case that that wasn't appropriated because these acts were separated by several years, occur in different states, and seem to be random opportunities. That's certainly not the case in this case. This is a well-constructed plan that was carried out over an extended period of time. The court noted that the probative value increased when Brandy testified because counsel inquired of the victim in regards to having sex with Adam. And this was, as defense counsel has indicated, an apparent attempt to give a reason why the victim had no hymen and essentially had a vaginal cavity, that of an adult woman, essentially. Adam's testimony of the sexual conduct with the victim at the behest of the defendant is incredibly probative to show it was the defendant who had the motive and the scheme to repeatedly sexually assault the victim. There was also mention made by the court in regards to when counsel inquired whether the victim was the only one to stay home from school, church, with the defendant, with the only inference being that she was the only one held back for the purpose of having sex with him. That's a clear inference from this. Defense counsel even went further to ask, okay, is it so it was only you, right? That's in the record page 460. This likewise made the defendant's motive and common scheme much more probative to understand the conduct.
The question I have is, Ms. Dustin raised the issue that Judge Lohr used it, that Ms. Dustin had opened the door to this instead of using 480452 as to the exception to evidence of a prior bad acts. What's your position on that, Mr. Chairman?
My position is that the court clearly was evaluating this to determine whether or not it met the requirements of Tinch. And in the course of that, she makes reference that these are a few of the considerations that she had in making that decision. It's not in total. Obviously, there's much more in that package. But
you believe that she based it on NRS 48045 rather than this open door policy?
That's correct, Judge, under the motive and common scheme plan exceptions. The district court's decision to admit the evidence is reviewed for abuse of discretion. The state submits that it's clear that the court did not abuse its discretion. I would note in regards to the expert testimony that our issue number three, that the expert testimony is not given proper notice. The court's defense counsel made mention of Detective or Dr. Stephen Karch. And I would note that that notice was given to the defense of both of the experts, Dan Burkholt and Stephen Karch, in regards to notice of experts and witnesses on July 25th, 06, April 11th, 07, and July 22nd of 08. In regards to Stephen Karch, certainly the CVs or curriculum vitaes were attached. Stephen Karch, as the justices have noted, was a doctor who indicated that he had credentials as a doctor. He had done an internship rotation in gynecology. At the time that he performed this exam, he was an ER doctor in the emergency room with duties to perform these sexual assault exams. The state submits that certainly he was appropriate to testify in this case. The defense counsel had a full opportunity to cross-examine him even after review of his reports. In regards to Mr. Burkable, the state would submit that in this particular case, the CV was not provided. It was the understanding from early on, as the court decided that the evidence in regards to the sexual assault kit was going to come in, that he was going to testify to that evidence. And in fact, the defense wanted him to testify to that evidence to explain this acid phosphatase and the effect of not finding the acid phosphatase. What was the exculpatory effect of that, and that there's no semen. He also testified in the course of his testimony that in fact he might not expect to find that acid phosphatase over an extended time previous. However, at all times, the evidence is exculpatory to the defense, and the defense wanted that evidence in. The state submits that certainly, similar to Mitchell v. State, the district court did not abuse discretion when it allowed Mr. Burkable to testify. Defense counsel also makes reference to insufficient evidence existing to support the conviction, and I would note that in this particular case, the state would submit even beyond the other bad act evidence, there's significant evidence. In this case, we have the victim's stepmother, in this case, the defendant's wife, Viola George, who was an eyewitness to the sexual contact between the defendant and the young victim. And matter of fact, she was a participant in some of that contact, and she, in fact, testified to that in the course of the trial. We have the victim herself, and it's clear that, as the case law has indicated, the victim herself and that testimony standing alone is sufficient to convict. And in this particular case, we have a 35-year-old woman, the state submits, with no visible reason to lie in this particular case or be dishonest. So her credibility was somewhat great. She also disclosed to two people before her disclosure, ultimately at her elementary school where the police were contacted, that would be both her brother Adam and her mother Viola, as to the sexual contact that the defendant was committing against her. The defendant admitted the prior abuse, that he abused this young child even outside the presence of his wife, Viola, to Viola. The sexual assault exam itself showed that the victim had no hymen, and this could only result from repeated sexual penetration. The defendant had the opportunity to commit this crime. Obviously, he was present in the residence at the time, had plenty of opportunity to be there with the victims. And when certainly you look at the other bad act evidence as well, we're shown the defendant's, even beyond all the other very strong evidence, we're shown the defendant's motive and the common scheme and plan he has in this particular case. The state would submit that certainly there was sufficient evidence. Thank you.
Ms. Dustin, rebuttal? You've got a little over a minute.
Very quickly, Your Honors. Regarding the bad act admission, I'd like to draw the court's attention to Volume 3 of the Appendix 478, and this is Judge Lohr. So I'm ruling that if the state wants to call Felicia Jr., they may do so. One of the reasons I'm doing that is because Ms. Brandy George was asked this morning in cross-examination if she was the only one in that household that was ever abused, and you're sure you were the only one, and I think as part of the state's motion for the whole story, then Ms. Jr. should testify if they want her to testify. So the court was very clear as to its reasoning. Again, the record does not support anywhere in there that the defense asked a question of Ms. Brandy George of whether she was the only one in the household that was ever abused. The record is completely absent of that, Your Honors, and I did cite to the record as to the full length of my cross-examination. As to the lewdness merging into the sexual assault, while Mr. Sweeten notes that there was a discussion as to fingers in the vagina more than five times or less than five times, the actual question is asked by the state at Volume 3, page 437 of the appendix, question by the state, in regards to the defendant placing his penis and fingers in your vagina, did he do that less than five times or more than five times? The answer was yes.
Well, thank you, Ms. Dustin. Thank you, Mr. Sweeten. Both of you lived up to my expectations of both of you. Very fine arguments on behalf of the defense and the state.